From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are other books about the politics and culture surrounding wolves in the American West, but Nate Blakeslee didn't want his book to be one of them. Which is not to say his reporting about wolves doesn't include those things. It has to, really. Politics and human fears have defined the lives of wolves for, well, forever. Still, what Blakeslee wanted to do was tell the story of one wolf in particular, as though she were a character in a novel. 06 was an alpha female in a Yellowstone wolf pack who reigned over the Lamar Valley. She was a brilliant hunter, crazy strong. And 06 anchors Blakeslee's book about how wolves live in the West and the forces that always make their existence uncertain. We'll talk about it after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What the heck does a Texan know about the complicated story of wolves in the West? How the last wolves born in Yellowstone National Park had been shot in 1926 by park rangers, by the way, who had given in to pressure and a truly ancient human fear about the predators. Blakeslee has written a book that tells the story of one wolf in particular, a charismatic alpha female in a Yellowstone pack. But what is a Texan know about wolves and how they've been at the center of a cultural clash reignited when they were reintroduced into the park in the Intermountain West in the 1990s. Blakeslee, who is a writer at large for Texas Monthly, lives in Austin. Well, he became fascinated with wolves the same way a lot of people have when he first saw one on a trip with his family to Yellowstone in 2007. His book is called American Wolf.
You know, I had often gone to Yellowstone as a young man when I was in college, but in those days there were no wolves in the park. And then I heard that they had been brought back, and I just sort of wanted to see it for myself. So right before my kids were born in 2007, I went out there. I took a week-long wolf-watching class, and I was just blown away by what I saw. I had no idea that you could reliably spot wolves every day from the roadside and watch them for hours. It was amazing.
But at what point did you think, oh, I want to write about this? I mean, you're settled there in Texas. You don't really have the same although it's similar, I'm sure, but your perspective is somewhat different from a Westerner, I guess. I mean, what were you thinking about it?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair question, and it's a question I often got up there. What does a guy from Texas care about wolves in the West? But one of the wonderful things about the West is that it belongs to everybody. It's part of our national heritage. So much of the West is public land, federal land. It's one of the favorite places for everybody to vacation. It has all these sort of amazing locations, Yellowstone and Yosemite. And so, you know, I always felt like the West belonged to me just as much as it did to anyone else who actually lived out there. And I think a lot of people feel that way, too. But then when I was out there on that trip, that's when I started to realize how rich the story was, because I didn't know that it was so controversial to bring wolves back to the park. I just knew that it was this wonderful reintroduction success story, that they had been gone for almost 100 years, that they were brought back in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. That the program was immensely successful and wolves spread throughout much of their former range in the Northern Rockies. But I did not realize how politically charged of a decision that was by the federal government to do that.
It's interesting. Your book isn't necessarily about the issue part. It seems, I've heard you describe that the way you wanted to tell the story was look at this particular wolf, this female, 06, which we'll get to, obviously,
yeah,
and write about her as though she were a character in a novel. At what point does that occur to you?
Well, when I was out there, I met this sort of small group, this subculture of wolf aficionados who live in and around the national park. They're led by this man named Rick McIntyre. He's a park ranger. He's sort of the park's wolf guru. He famously has never missed a day in the park or at the time that I went out there for 15 years straight. His job is to helps the biologists in the park spot wolves. And then also he talks to visitors to the park about the wolves. And he's this amazing font of sort of wolf folklore in Yellowstone. He can spot almost any wolf and tell you that wolf's lineage, who its parents were, who its grandparents were, where it was born, sort of all the decisive events in its life. He really is a folklorist. And what I didn't realize until I went out there is how much detail was available on each individual wolf's life. And specifically, this one wolf who, sort of by happenstance of being the most visible wolf in the park, became the most famous wolf in the park. As you say, she was known as the 06 female. That was her nickname for the year in which she was born. Once wolves get a research collar, they'll be given a number by the biologists that sort of run the wolf project there. But she had never been collared, so they just called her the 06 female. And what I didn't realize is how closely her life had been observed. Yeah. The real breakthrough came when I met one of these wolf watchers. Her name was Lori Lyman. Mm-hmm. She's a retired school teacher from San Diego. She had spent every day for 3 years, almost every day, in the park watching this one particular pack led by 06, the alpha female of this pack, and had taken daily notes. And she gave them to me. It was like this treasure trove of material, 3 years worth, 2,400 pages worth of notes about this one wolf and her family.
It's interesting. There's this book that a lot of people will remember from a few years ago called The Tiger. Is it Valant, I think is how he pronounces the name.
I think you're right,
And that seemed to be a kind of an influence for you. He writes a book about the tiger from the tiger's perspective, kind of in the same way you've done this with 06.
Yeah, I read that book. In fact, I dissected that book when I was doing research for this book. Because as you say, that was a book that was, he tried something similar. Let's see if we can make a character, a central character in the book, even though it's a character that you can't really get inside the mind of, and obviously there's no dialogue, and so it's a challenge. It's something you ordinarily would see maybe in a novel. The only reason it was possible with 06 is because of the amount of detail we had about her life. Lori Lyman and her friends, Rick and others, were there when 06, as a lone wolf, found the wolf that would become her mate. Lori was there when 06 outwitted and then later defeated the alpha female of the pack that held this prime habitat in the park known as Little Mar Valley, and 06 took it over as her own. She was there when 06 had her first litter of pups. She was there when 06 fought off this grizzly in this day-long battle to defend her den. All of this stuff, all of these nuggets of gold were in this diary that she gave me that day, and I read the entire thing, and I just realized what you could do with this material. You could write a nonfiction book that reads like a novel in which large stretches of it have nothing but wolves in it as characters.
Before we get to those characters, the wolves, which are, of course, are the main characters in the book, we need to talk about Rick a little bit more.
Sure.
How do you describe him? I keep coming up with the idea or the word eccentric. For sure. I mean, he is, as you said just a little bit earlier, a man who didn't want to leave the area, didn't really want to leave the Lamar Valley, and didn't for years and years and years.
Yeah.
He'd tried a relationship of his own, didn't quite work out, seems to be the type who was just comfortable being alone and deeply passionate, I guess, about wildlife and that landscape up there.
Yeah. He is as obsessed with wolves as I have ever encountered anyone who's obsessed with anything. And that's what makes him such a fascinating character. He's in his mid-60s. He's unmarried, never been married, no kids, doesn't even have a dog. The wolves basically are his life there. Yeah. He thinks of them as his family. And his daily routine never changed for 15 years, from reintroduction in 1995 until right around the year 2010. He went to the park every single morning, usually about an hour before dawn, whether he was on the clock or off the clock. He would use his telemetry equipment to spot or find wolves. You know, they wear these radio collars that send off a signal. He would set up his spotting scope, which is what you use to watch wolves in the park. It's a very powerful telescope mounted on a tripod. Yeah. He would wait for the sun to come up. He would watch wolves all day long, and he would take notes on this tape recorder that he kept in his pocket. And when he got home in the afternoon, he would transcribe those notes. And at the time I first met him, he had something close to 5 million words worth of notes, 10,000 single space pages worth of notes. And some of them were full of these amazing scenes like I just described, but others were unbelievably mundane because Rick literally wrote down every single thing he saw.
It's interesting. You tell the story of how Rick in those early days was kind of causing problems for his supervisors. I mean, he was eager to talk to anyone who would listen about these wolves, but the management didn't really like this idea. As you say in the book, wolf reintroduction was about making an ecosystem whole. It wasn't supposed to be about creating this tourist attraction, but Rick really stirred people up, and he just couldn't be deterred from that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when they brought wolves back to the park, they introduced them to this area known as the Lamar Valley, relatively wide, treeless area. They were very much hoping to see maybe a couple of instances of wolves bringing down elk, which is something that had seldom been observed in the wild. And then they assumed the wolves would just sort of disperse into the interior of the park, and you would need a horse or, more likely, a plane to observe them. And some of the wolves did leave, but others remained. And they didn't seem to mind the fact that there was a road going through the middle of the valley or there were cars or people on it. They just sort of learned to adjust to the presence of people. Now, the people don't get very close to them. You're, you know, usually at least a mile away. Yeah. But with these scopes, you know, what you can see is just amazing. And Rick wanted to be there. He didn't want to miss anything. He knew his job was to talk to visitors about wolves. So sort of as a compromise, he would set up his scope. And anyone who came near him, he would say, "Would you like to see a wolf?"
Yeah.
And Rick, more than anybody else, probably is the responsible for this birth of what has now become a very popular pastime in the park, which is wolf watching. Yeah. Yellowstone is the one place in the world where you can reliably spot a wolf from the roadside. It's a wolf watching mecca.
You write about this, how the regulars, the aficionados, as you described them, and how social that experience. In some ways, it's a solitary experience, but you also write it's a very social experience. And you write about this this man named Adolf Murie, who wrote this piece back in 1944 and describes, I think this was in Canada maybe, describes the thrill of watching wolves. Talk a little bit about that part, about the thrill of watching them, the social idea of being together, talking about them. I mean, it's a pretty interesting subculture.
Well, one of the most enjoyable things for me about reporting this book was, you know, all of the reporting was done in Yellowstone. And I spent a lot of time around Rick, watching Rick interact, not just with the watchers, but with visitors, people who only come to the park once in their lifetimes. And the most rewarding thing for me, and I know for Rick too, was watching people see a wolf for the first time. Because you walk up to this group of people behind their scopes, you look at this ridge that they're looking at, it's a mile away or more. You see nothing on the ridge. Even with your binoculars, you see nothing.
Yeah.
And somehow they say, "Well, what are you doing?" "Well, we're watching wolves through our scopes." And somehow they never seem to believe that they're actually going to see a wolf until they lean down and put their eye in the eyepiece. Most of them have never used one of these spotting scopes. They're difficult to use. And when that moment when they see one and they just expressions of joy that comes out of their mouths, it's one of those few, those rare instances where you will see a middle-aged person behaving like a little kid. Because they're just so overcome with joy at seeing this amazing thing that no one has seen for so long and that no one in this country really feels like they ever will get to see in their lifetime.
Well, eventually the park supervisors, they transfer him to the they transfer Rick McIntyre to the biology department. And this is where he comes in contact with another human character in the book, Doug Smith. Smith hires Rick full-time and it's interesting how Rick, you say, is inspired by Jane Goodall. I mean, the experience she has, this idea of if you're going to see something important or if you're going to document these creatures in the proper way, you have to be there. It's all about showing up, I think, is how you put it in the book.
Yeah, yeah. In that sense, Rick is a real throwback because modern wildlife biology is about you collar the wolf. You follow it from a plane, you make some observations, or if you have an extremely modern collar like they have now, it has GPS in it, and you can sit at your desk in your office and watch where that wolf is going and plot data points and write a paper about, you know, the range of a particular pack. It has largely fallen out of fashion to do what, for example, Adolf Murie did in Mount McKinley in the 1940s, which is go out there, set up your scope and watch wolves all day long, every day, and take notes on what you see. And Rick very much considers himself to be sort of in the tradition of Adolf Murie. that he feels like if you're not there, you might miss something. Now, some people would say he takes that to an extreme that most biologists would not. However, as Rick likes to point out, and justifiably so, Jane Goodall had no official training when she was first assigned to go out there and watch those chimps. And what she observed chimps using tools to get termites out of a termite mound. She observed them dipping a stick in there. And if you had asked her or any other large primate researcher, is a chimp smart enough to use a tool to get what it wants? She would have said no the day before she observed that behavior. So like Rick said, to some degree, he's right. There is no substitute for being there.
That's Nate Blakeslee. His book is called American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about wolves in the West with Nate Blakeslee, who's written a book that talks about one wolf in particular, about the human who tried to protect her, the one who killed her, and the cultural and political battles behind the story. The book is called American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. Well, let's talk about 06, the main character, I guess, in the book, this female wolf. To be able to understand, I think, her story, though, you have to explain the Druid Peak Pack. This is the second group of wolves brought into the park. This was in 1996. The Druids, as you just mentioned not so long ago, that they could have spread out, and everyone was expecting them to. They'll drop them off in the Lamar Valley, but they figured that they would spread out. But as you point out in the book, they preferred to stay and fight it out.
Right. The Druids were the pack that sort of held that key territory, the Lamar Valley, for the first decade of reintroduction, starting from 96 until sort of 2006 or so, 2007. And that made them sort of the face of the reintroduction project. They were the pack that everybody saw because the Lamar Valley is the place where it's easiest to spot wolves. And so for thousands, tens of thousands of visitors, when they thought of wolves in Yellowstone, they thought of the Druids. And this was also true because several really well-produced and well-received documentaries were made about the Druids. One of them won an Emmy by this guy who's almost as dedicated as Rick's. Name's Bob Landis, comes to the park every day and films wolves. And the Druids lived this wonderful story. They were an immensely successful pack. At one time, they were the largest recorded pack ever in the history of people watching wolves, 37 of them. Wow. A typical pack is maybe 8 to 10. And so they sort of held this key habitat in the park for so long, and so many of their offspring dispersed to start new packs of their own that their bloodline sort of was all over the park by this beginning of the second decade. And Rick sort of called them the Kennedy family of Yellowstone wolves. They were like American royalty in Yellowstone. And that's where her story begins too, because her grandmother was the matriarch of the Druids, the longtime matriarch known as 42. Right. And so she is sort of descended from that famous bloodline that began with the Druids in Lamar Valley.
42 brings up, I think, an important point that you make a few times actually in the book. 42 becomes the alpha female after she and her sisters usurp a particularly vicious female named Number 40. And you tell the story of how 42 and her sisters had basically had enough, and they attacked her. They killed her, basically. And this question of how vicious to be, how much empathy to show, seems, and this idea of the social life of these creatures is an important theme in the book, and I wanted you to talk about that.
Well, I think what Rick, as a sort of an ambassador for wolves to the general public, and Lori and other people who follow the wolves in Yellowstone, what they feel like they must work against, or this boulder that they've been pushing up this hill, is this long-held notion that wolves are nothing but cold-blooded killers, that they're killing machines. And that is the way our ancestors thought of them, going all the way back to the very first you know, humans who raised livestock. Wolves were once the most widely distributed land mammal on the planet, and anywhere that human civilization spread, they encountered wolves. And wolves were an obstacle to raising livestock, and therefore wolves became the enemy. Yeah. And this has been handed down through mythology and through folklore. Think of Grimm's fairy tales, the werewolf tale, all of the metaphors in our language in which the wolf is the enemy, the wolf at the door. And so that's what Rick and Lori are fighting against. That's what Adolf Murray was fighting against when they tried to tell the true story of wolves. And the truth is that they are much more than killing machines. And that empathy that you alluded to is a key quality that you see in wolves. And it's not something that is in Rick's mind. It's not anthropomorphizing. Mm-hmm. Empathy is necessary to the survival of a pack. Wolves do everything collectively. The pack is essentially a family. You've got a breeding pair, the alpha male and female. You've got the pups. And then you've got older generations of offspring that have yet to disperse. They do everything collectively. They hunt collectively. They defend the den collectively. Yeah. They raise and feed the pups collectively. And they have to get along. Unlike, say, a mountain lion or a grizzly that will spend 90% of its life alone, wolves are always in the company of other wolves. And that ability to read the emotional state of a fellow wolf and respond accordingly is a trait that has been selected for over thousands of years, just like their amazing sense of hearing or smell or agility or stamina. It's something that they had to have in order to survive, and you can see it through the scope. You can see them struggling to get along with one another and to live harmoniously as a group.
You tell the story about the alpha male of the Druid clan for a time, 21, who had expressed this tenderness, this kind of empathy for this disabled pup. And all of the disabled pups, something was wrong with the pup. I'm not sure what it was. And all of his siblings were, you know, picking on him, you know, not paying any attention. But the alpha male, 21, paid attention and expressed this empathy. And you say that this was something that Rick had never really seen until that point.
Yeah. Yeah, 21 was by far Rick's favorite wolf. He's the one that he has the most stories about and talks about the most. And he considered him to be this wonderful blend of qualities. You know, he called him Superman because he had that rare blend of sort of, you know, he was amazingly strong. His prowess as a hunter and a fighter was unmatched. But he also had this sort of kind of noble and tender side. And that incident you described is one of Rick's favorite stories, watching 21 be gentle with a pup and care for his pups, you know, in a way that we normally associate, with a human. Yeah. And that was one of the things that Rick loved about 21. But that was not the only instance. You know, you would often see that. And the way that the life of the pack is so focused around their offspring, the way that male wolves will adopt, care for, and raise another wolf's offspring. In the rare instance that happens, if a male alpha male were to die and the alpha female had to take on a new mate, you know, you might expect, for example, among big cats, the new male would kill those kittens as a threat to his future dominance. But wolves instead will care for those pups as though they were their own. And the bond that they form is almost immediate, and it's something you rarely see in the animal world except in canines and of course, in humans.
I think people who read the book are really going to be taken with these various stories of these wolf characters. 42 and 21, you really come to care for as a reader, I have to say. Can we say something about number 42, how she lived nearly 9 years of age? And then you write about how she dies this was February 1st of 2004.
Yeah, she, at the very beginning of the Druid's reign, and this is what's so wonderful about Rick, he has all of this folklore in his head. But at the very beginning that the Druids took over the valley was not empty. There was a pack there, which is today known as the Molly's Pack. And the Druids drove them out of the pack, killed the alpha male. The alpha female and what was left of her tribe sort of went off deep into the snowy interior of Yellowstone, up into this high valley known as the Pelican. It was not good habitat, but it was like where they stopped running. It was where they finally felt safe. And they stayed there for years and years. And against all odds, they survived up there. They survived, by the way, by learning to hunt bison, which is something that most packs in the park would never even attempt because the bison are so huge and so dangerous. So they're hanging on for survival up there. Meanwhile, the Druids are flourishing. 42 and 21's reign is this long, sort of benevolent, golden era of the Druids. Yeah. But every so often, the mollies would make an appearance. They would come down out of the Pelican, which was too high and snowy to hold elk in the winter. The elk would leave. And so the mollies would come down looking for better hunting. And one of the places they would go was that old land that they once controlled, the Lamar Valley. And on one of those excursions, they happened to find 42 wandering by herself. She was 9 years old. She was past her prime. And they did what comes naturally to wolves. You know, when they meet on another wolf's territory and on one pack is on another pack's territory, their conflict is inevitable. Yeah. They found her and they killed her. And that was the end of her reign. And then, of course, 21 had to find another mate himself, but he wasn't long for the world anyway either. And that was sort of the beginning of the end of the Druid's reign.
You say the pack never enjoyed the same stability they once had. And this is where we make way for 06. Tell a little bit about those early days. She's playing hide and seek with the Druids, yet she lingered in Druid territory, seemed to be connected to that place in interesting ways.
Yeah. At the time the book starts, she has been on her own for a couple of years. She's about 3 years old. Every wolf who wants to breed must leave their home territory because, generally speaking, only the alpha male and female, the mother and father of the pack, will breed. Because there's only enough room in the territory, there's only enough prey to support one family. And so in order to establish your own family, you have to disperse from your pack, become the so-called lone wolf, that term everybody knows. But the lone wolf is not going off to be by his or herself. The lone wolf is going off to find another wolf and establish a new family and hopefully a territory of their own. But it's very dangerous because every part of Yellowstone is held by one pack or another. And so that lone wolf is risking, in this case, 06, was risking her life to try to find a mate in a territory. And she became fixated on trying to draw these two young males away from the Druid pack. And at this time, the Druids were sort of in decline. 42 and 21 had been gone for several years. The pack's fate had sort of, their numbers had dwindled. Yeah. And they happened to all have mange at this one point in which she's trying to draw these males out. And they themselves are extremely reliant on these two young males. They've got to have them. If they don't, there's no future for them. But she herself wants them too. And so it becomes this battle of wits between her, 06, and the new alpha female of the Druids known as White Line to see who will successfully woo these young males and whose pack will prosper and whose will not.
You tell the story of one February, I think it was, how this trio, she wins them over, these two brothers, and this trio goes after a bull elk. And then the bull elk happens to come to the road, the paved road, I guess it was. Her companions, the two males, they're put off by the road, don't know what to make of it. She's not. And she brings this bull elk down, I think, herself. Would you tell this story? This was a kind of an amazing story, I thought. The sense of fearlessness that she had.
Yeah. She as you say, she won these two young males away. They became known as 754 and 755, these two brothers. 755 became her mate, and 754 became sort of the third wheel, but stayed in the pack and was never kicked out. But it immediately became evident that she was the leader of the trio. Simply by virtue of being the more experienced wolf, she was 3 years old, they were yearlings. And when she took them on, they were less, as I say in the book, equal partners and more like trainees. And and for the longtime watchers who had been watching 06 for some time, it was a curious decision to hook up with these two wolves, to sort of hitch her wagon to theirs, because they weren't very good at being wolves. There's no other good way to put it. You know, they didn't really know how to hunt. They were extremely timid. And on that one instance in which you described, she was leading them on a chase of a bull. The elk are enormous. They're in the deer family, but they're huge. The bulls can be 700 pounds. Yeah. 06 weighed about 100 pounds. So typically it takes an entire pack to bring them down. The lighter, faster females will run the elk to exhaustion, and then the big males, like 754, will come around and grab them by the windpipe and choke them to death. Well, she's chasing this enormous bull down this hill. They come to the road. She dashes across it like it's nothing. and the two of them just stop. They've never seen anything like it. They're afraid of it. They won't get on it. So it's left to her to continue chasing the bull, and it was in her nature to just say, well, if the two of them aren't going to help me, I am going to do it myself. And she had, and by this time the watchers had seen her do it several times, she had perfected the art of bringing an elk, even a big bull, down by herself, which is part of the way that her, sort of her legend grew. Yeah. You know, she wasn't a super wolf, but she was pretty amazing at what she did.
There's a scene I want to have you read, if you don't mind. It's this really beautiful moment where 06 is howling. Do you need to set this up for us?
Well, she has just had her first litter of pups, and they live in this sort of bucolic, wide open bowl on the side of this mountain, which happens to be perfectly visible from a campground road. Yeah. And so the watchers are all down there watching her every morning as she and 754 and 755 raise this first litter of pups. Situated high on the mountainside, the den had a clear view of the flats of Slough Creek far below, as well as the Lamar River, where it exited Lamar Canyon, and beyond a long arm of Specimen Ridge. One morning, as the pups were playing on a fallen log, and 754 and 755 were bedded nearby, 06 walked to the center of the bowl and sat in a field of luxurious grass, surveying the mountainside that dropped away below her. Suddenly, she threw her muzzle into the air and howled. The two males roused themselves and trotted to her side to join in. The pups scampered over, confused and startled, looking everywhere for the danger that had prompted their mother to sound this alarm. But there was no danger. There was just warm sunshine and soft grass and the bounty of an enormous territory that belonged only to them. They tilted their tiny heads back and added their voices to the chorus.
You write that whenever Rick would hear a howl, that he would stop talking and he would urge people to listen. What is the significance of a howl? The pups thought there was some danger, but they don't just howl when there's danger. There's something else going on, too.
Yeah, as Rick loved the howls, and all the watchers love the howls, because when you're watching wolves through the scope, they're a mile away or even more. And so it's like watching a silent movie. You know, you sort of have to imagine the kind of yips and the yelps and the growling and whatever it is that you're seeing. But when they howl, you can hear it because it echoes through the valleys and off the mountains. And it's just this amazing sort of otherworldly sound. And, of course, visitors to the park always ask Rick, what does it mean? Why are they howling? And they could be howling for any number of reasons. Sometimes they howl. If wolves become separated from one another in a pack, they'll howl to locate one another. That might be one of the most common reasons. But they'll also howl to warn off a neighboring pack that they feel is encroaching on their territory. Sometimes they howl just as what seems to be a kind of morale-boosting exercise when they all sort of rouse themselves in the evening and get ready to go out for a hunt. Sometimes they'll do what's called a rally. They jump all over one another like your dog does when you come home from work to you. And then they'll howl, just sort of it seems to be kind of a bonding sort of exercise. And sometimes they howl just when they seem to be enjoying life or happy or trying to, you know, it seems to be an expression of almost some kind of sort of familial, sort of expressing the familial bond. Yeah. It's something that everybody, all the members of the pack will do together. To sort of express their satisfaction at being with one another. So, and sometimes they howl for no evident reason whatsoever. Yeah. You know, the wolves have been so thoroughly studied for so long, but there's a lot we still don't understand about them.
I mean, that particular moment seemed like just a moment of joy.
Yeah, it did. It seemed to be her saying, expressing some satisfaction at what she had accomplished after, you know, a couple of years of literally wandering in the wilderness. She had found or created for herself by sort of her sheer force of will a home and a family. And she did seem to be sort of expressing some sort of satisfaction. And what could be better than having the rest of her family join in?
Nate Blakeslee. His book is called American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Nate Blakeslee. His book is called American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. Well, part of the story, of course, is the management of wolves. This comes into play. And these years of back and forth about whether or not wolves will be delisted on the endangered species list, who is going to control the management of wolves. There's this particular moment. One of the, you say, the most profound changes for the story is when the management of wolves is returned to state control, in Idaho and Montana in particular. Talk a little bit about this part of the story. Obviously, this is an important context for it. You mentioned we talked about Doug Smith earlier. Doug Smith and I think a lot of the other advocates, you know, for the wolf, biologists of wolves, they didn't believe wolves needed to be sacred. You know, they thought it was okay to shoot some troublesome wolves, I suppose. But this question of where they fit in the ecosystem and this question of whether they were killing elk and killing livestock, I mean, you know, this is an important bit of context we have to understand, I guess.
Sure. And that's the other big story that the book tells. You've got this sort of two narrative threads, the story of 06 and her family, and then the story of this political struggle over how wolves ought to be managed. As we mentioned earlier, we discussed earlier, bringing the wolves back to the Northern Rockies was controversial. Not everybody thought it was a good idea. The chief opponents were ranchers, maybe for obvious reasons. You know, all the ranchers that sort of helped eliminate wolves from the Northern Rockies, essentially by the end of the 19th century, their descendants were still there, still running cattle and sheep, and in some cases on public land. And they opposed bringing wolves back. And then also elk hunting is really big business in the Northern mm-hmm. Rockies. You know, you've got your guide services. You've got your hotels and restaurants that cater to hunters. People will come from all over the country or the world to hunt elk, especially right there around Yellowstone. And so they were very much opposed too. And part of the deal that was made when the federal government brought wolves back was they promised the states, if you will allow us to do this, then when wolves are sufficiently numerous and their population is stable, we will take them off the endangered species list and we will return management to the states and you can manage them like you would any other animal. And it was assumed and acknowledged at the time that that would mean there would eventually would be a hunting and even a trapping season for wolves. And that date finally did come in 2009. They began hunting and trapping in Idaho and Montana. And then in 2012, they began hunting and trapping in Wyoming, which is, as your listeners know, which is where Yellowstone is actually located.
Yeah, there's that concession they had to make, and that any reintroduced wolves that preyed on livestock were going to be shot. And you write about one particular story, one of the worst days in the life of a man named Carter Niemeyer.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. He was one of the guys who was essential to the reintroduction project. He worked for the federal government, but ironically, he had been a hunter and trapper, a government hunter and trapper most of his life. There is an agency of the federal government. It's now known as Wildlife Services. Back in the day, it was known as Animal Damage Control. You can call them and they will come and remove so-called nuisance animals from your ranch or from public land that you have leased from the government to run your cattle and sheep on. And so they will shoot mountain lions. They will shoot eagles if you're in the sheep business. They shoot a lot of coyotes. And beginning in 1995, 1996, when wolves were brought back to the Northern Rockies, they came under pressure from ranchers to begin shooting wolves too. And they shot quite a few of them. And the logic of it probably is a little hard to follow if you're not from the West or even if you are from the West. I mean, here you've got one division of the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service, bringing predators back onto public land and celebrating that accomplishment. You've got another, the Forest Service, leasing that same public land to ranchers, essentially inviting them to bring helpless sheep and cattle onto that land where the predators are. And then a third division, Wildlife Services, that will come out free of charge to you and shoot those same wolves when they inevitably prey on sheep and cattle. So it's, you know, it's like something out of Dr. Strangelove, you know, or Catch-22. There is a logic to it, but it's a perverse sort of logic. It reminds me of that expression that, I think it's from the 70s, some diplomat said that some plan was both perfectly logical and perfectly insane. And it is a little hard to wrap your head around if you're not from the West, or as I say, even if you are.
Did you get a sense, Nate Blakeslee, about the intensity of the feeling that exists about wolves? Did you get a sense about that? You mention Barry Lopez in the book, the naturalist and writer, who mentioned that it wasn't just hatred, that it was also envy going on.
Yeah. I can't recommend that book enough. Barry Lopez of Wolves and Men came out in the late 70s, still a classic. It's a book-length meditation on this sort of fraught relationship between these two species, yeah. Homo sapiens and Canis lupus, and going all the way back to, as we discussed earlier, the very first people to try to run livestock. It's difficult to understand the degree to which some people in the West resented the idea that wolves were going to be brought back by the federal government, unless you go there and you talk to people about it and you see it in person. And to some degree, it has become less about the actual wolves and the putative damage that they do on the ground. In other words, the number of sheep and cattle they kill, or the reduction in the elk herd, which, after all, was part of the goal of bringing them back to Yellowstone, was to reduce that oversized elk herd in the park, which was damaging the habitat. Yeah. And that happened. But if you didn't share that policy goal to begin with, you know, if you were hunting those same elk in Yellowstone as they came down in the winter into those valleys around the park, if you didn't share that goal, you weren't likely to celebrate its success. But now I feel like the fight now is the anti-wolf sentiment you see is a way of expressing opposition to what you see as an overreaching federal government, to bureaucrats that are not responsive in Washington, that live thousands of miles away and don't understand a way of life, or to an overreaching federal judge who in your eyes is making law that should better be left to Congress. And the politics has become so poisonous now. If you're a certain kind of politician in the West, your position on wolves is a kind of a litmus test. It's like your position on abortion or on gun control. It's a way of signaling to voters who you are as a politician and what you stand for. And it's become so far removed from the actual events on the ground.
That brings us to another important character in the story, a man you call Stephen Turnbull. It's not his real name, and we can maybe explain why you don't give his real name. He asked you not to, but he's the hunter who eventually brought down 06. And you say in the book that Stephen Turnbull hadn't lost his living to the wolves. Like, he wasn't an outfitter. I mean, he hunted. It was important to him. Incredibly important to him, hunting. But you say, since he hadn't lost his living, he did feel like he had lost something else, something harder to define. Explain Stephen Turnbull and some of these other hunters' relationships, the way they feel about wolves.
Yeah, Stephen Turnbull, as you say, he was the person who happened to come across 06 during the first legal hunting season for wolves in Wyoming, probably in 80 years. Obviously, wolves are always protected when they're in Yellowstone, but all of Yellowstone's packs have enormous ranges, and from time to time, each pack leaves the park. And 06 happened to lead her pack out of the park into this valley east of Yellowstone known as Crandall. Just briefly, during that first legal hunting season, and who could have foreseen that during that first season, one of the first wolves shot would be the most celebrated wolf in the park, arguably the most famous wolf in the world. He did not know he was shooting a famous wolf. He didn't find out until later that day the identity of the wolf that he had shot, and the backlash against it was just enormous. I mean, from his perspective, it was an extremely surreal experience. He lives in this very remote valley. He lives in this cabin. He doesn't even have a landline. He's never used Google. He's never used email. He lives in this sort of 19th century bubble that exists in some parts of the West. Yeah. And the next day, he does something in one of the remotest places in the lower 48 at dawn by himself. The next day, it's in the New York Times, and then it's around the world. And for him, it was an extremely surreal experience. He kept his name out of the papers, probably wisely, or he would have been the next Cecil the Dentist, Minnesota. Yeah. Cecil the Lion, Minnesota Dentist story. But by the time I caught up with him, which was about a year after he shot her, he had changed his mind. And he was ready to tell his side of the story, provided that we didn't use his real name to protect his privacy. In his own way, he is as obsessed with wildlife as Rick McIntyre is in the park. He is obsessed with elk. He essentially has built his life around hunting. He's like a ski bum, as I said in the book, you know, with a rifle instead of a snowboard. Yeah. He spends all his time stalking elk. He collects elk sheds in the winter to get an idea of sort of where the biggest bulls are living so that he'll be ready when fall comes around again to find those bulls. And he very much resents the fact that there are dramatically fewer elk in Crandall than there were when he was a boy. And he attributes most of that decline to the wolves next door in Yellowstone. And to a degree, he's right. You know, that the Yellowstone elk herd was enormous, way bigger than it should have been. But to him and his dad and his granddad, that was normal because that was the number of elk that had always been there after the wolves were killed off, you know, by the, say, 1910, 1920. And so when the wolves were brought back, he was very much opposed to it. And at every winter, as he saw fewer and fewer elk come down into his valley, he was more and more resentful. And when that first wolf hunting season came around, he got a tag because he was determined to express his anger, to do something about this problem that he had so, felt so helpless about for so long.
Didn't regret it. He did acknowledge it was a sad scene. He mentioned 755, her mate howling over her body. Which is it's a dreadful scene, I have to say. And he thought it was sad, but he didn't regret it.
Well, when I first encountered him, he had just watched this documentary, I think it was on the Nat Geo channel, about 06's life. And it didn't mention anything about politics. There were no people in it whatsoever, and it didn't talk about how controversial wolves were and reintroduction and hunting and all that. But at the very end, it does mention that her life was cut short by a hunter's bullet. And something about that, this stock photography image of a hunter and this crack of the rifle and this ominous voiceover, it just got to him. And he, you know, his reaction was, I am not a stock photography image of a hunter. You know, I am a person and I have a perspective and I have a story and I feel it's not being told. Now, to some degree, that was his fault. He refused to talk to reporters for a year. But I think that was part of his motivation. And so when I first started talking to him in the cabin, he was extremely defensive. You know, because he knew that he, even though his name was not known, he knew he was a widely hated person in you know, in certain circles. And so he was very defensive that first day. But he was not an anti-wolf ideologue. He didn't believe, like some of his rancher buddies did, that every single wolf in Crandall needed to be killed. And I think at one point he even said, wolves are neat. Yeah. But he was not willing to admit that he had done something wrong. He kept insisting that what he had done was legal. And you know, strictly speaking, he was right. He had a permit. She was outside the park, and he shot her. Whether or not it was morally wrong, I think to some degree he maybe was on the fence about that. And he wanted to hear, he wanted to know at some level why she was so beloved, because he didn't understand that. And he'd heard very little about it, and he kept asking me over and over again, you know, what did the wolf lovers in the park say? You know, why did they love this wolf? And he was curious about that. And I think that's part of the reason he let me into the cabin in the first place.
She didn't tell me she was famous before I shot her, he told me.
Right. That's what he said.
And let me ask you this finally. There's this moment when you're visiting with Stephen Turnbull. And he, about an hour into the conversation, he offers to show you 06's pelt that he had kept. He had had it professionally tanned. And I want to have you talk a little bit about seeing the actual pelt after having heard these stories, seeing the actual skin. And there's this moment when you noticed, he notices you shooting video of it, and he wants you to stand next to it. And there's this kind of reluctance you feel about all of it. Would you talk about that finally?
Yeah, well, first of all, it did not occur to me that he would have her pelt there in the cabin, because I knew he had a house in town too, and he told me that's where all his trophies were. And as you say, we'd been talking for about an hour, and then finally said, well, do you want to see it? And I didn't realize immediately that he was talking about her pelt. And he brought it out, and I mean, I'll be frank with you, it was upsetting. And by that time, I had been talking for weeks or maybe months with watchers in the park, and they had been describing, I never saw 06 myself, but they were describing all this amazing behavior and all these things they had seen her do. And this, and by that time, I knew the outlines of this amazing adventure story that was her life. You know, she lived like a Jack London story. And you know, I'm a journalist and it's my job to be objective. And yet I was extremely moved by the stories that they had told me. And to see her reduced to that state, you know, just a pelt, you know, and to be invited to, you know, look at her paws, how big they were, look at how long she was. And I, you know, it was a difficult thing for me as a journalist to go through. But at the same time, I had no idea how to explain to him why that should be. And even as I sit here today, I'm not sure it would have been a good idea to do that. Because I was there to get his story. And that's why I was in the cabin that day. And later when I went home or went back to the cabin that I was staying in and I had time to think about and process what I'd seen and heard, that was when it really sank into me how rich the story was. Because it became clear to me that it's a story about values. And he and I were both standing next to the same object and having a drastically different reaction to it emotionally. He was so proud to have that pelt hanging on that peg on his cabin wall. And I was struggling to control my emotions at the same time. It was so upsetting for me. And that, as a journalist, you know that you've gotten into a rich story if there's that level of emotion involved, and if there's that sort of clash of sort of cultures and clash of values involved. And so in the end, it heightened my resolve to tell the story and to tell it right.
Nate Blakeslee is the author of the book American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. Joined us from NPR station KUT in Austin. Nate, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Doug. I enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.